So I'm going to talk to you mostly about Bose-Einstein condensation of photons and the few things around that. And hopefully towards the end, I'll actually get time to talk to you about a concept I think is I would like some input on, which is about non-stationary statistics as a tool to understand phase transitions. The system I'm going to talk about is incredibly simple physically. It is simply a pair of mirrors, about a micron apart, filled with some dye. And the fluorescent dye is this kind of pink dye. It's orange when it's in solution, but it's pink. And it probably is the same thing we use in these pens. It's called rhodamine. There's a variety of them, but it really is a very standard dye. And we pump it optically, and we observe the light that comes out. That's it. Two mirrors, dye, light, and that's it. Very simple. But hopefully it leads. You'll see that it leads to a very rich system with all sorts of interesting equilibrium and non-equilibrium phase transitions. So the archetypal phase transition I'm going to start with is the Bose-Einstein phase transition. This is pretty well understood. It's the kind of thing we describe to undergraduates. Don't worry about the definition. I'm not really worried about it. But we have a distribution which is characterized by two parameters, the temperature and the chemical potential. The temperature tells you this is clearly a thermal equilibrium phenomenon. We're describing, from this point of view, a thermal equilibrium problem. The chemical potential tells you two things. One, it tells you the number of particles there will be in the system. And two, it tells you the kind of how particles are exchanged between the system and a reservoir. And so immediately we see that this standard undergraduate problem is actually an open quantum system problem. There is no such thing as a closed system Bose-Einstein condensate if you take that definition of the Bose-Einstein condensate. Fine. The problem with making Bose-Einstein condensates of photons rather than anything else is that photons don't really have a well-defined chemical potential. If you take photons in a black box, the minimum energy required to add or remove a photon is essentially zero as the box goes to be infinitely large, which implies that the chemical potential is either zero or undefined, depending on your preference. So to make photons have a chemical potential, which is the typical energy required to add a particle to the system, to make them have a chemical potential, we need to put them in a system which has a gap of sorts. And so the simplest way of doing that is to make them interact with a medium which has a gap, like a semiconductor or a dye. A dye in this case has a ground electronic state and an excited electronic state, vibrational states, but there's definitely a gap between them. And if you want to know more about that, I very much recommend reading this paper by Werfel from 1982 called On the Chemical Potential of Radiation. It's some very simple calculations which really take a lot of unpicking and understanding. To be a little bit more specific about the system we use, we optically pump a laser dye. Rhodamine 6G has a very high fluorescence quantum yield, which implies that every time you excite it, the de-excitation is by emission of a photon and not something else. We don't do chemistry with this. We don't extract electrons. We just get light back out. The ground electronic state and the excited electronic state, there are others, but I'm going to ignore them. There are basically only two for any real problems of interest in this talk. But each of them have a spectrum of rho vibrational states, which are so closely packed, they're effectively a continuum. The equilibration among those vibrational states is very fast. This is a liquid at room temperature. The equilibration is in perhaps tens of femtoseconds. And so you reach a kind of a thermal equilibrium distribution of vibrational states faster than, for example, spontaneous emission, which is typically about 4 nanoseconds for these states. Okay? Another parameter which is important is how long does it take the light to be absorbed. If the light is propagating through a medium of this dye, it will be absorbed in some length scale, some time scale, and we can tune that between about 1 and 1,000 picoseconds, depending on what we want. So typically, faster than spontaneous emission, but much slower than the vibrational relaxation. And the implication is that every time a photon is absorbed by a dye molecule, it's then re-emitted with a different energy. So photons scatter off dye molecules and they exchange energy with the thermal bath of a vibrational degrees of freedom of the solvent. Okay. The consequence of this rapid relaxation plus the high quantum yield, plus the lack of any weird structures that we don't really want, essentially why the dye is very boring is that it has very effective and one of the most boring but most widely used dyes, is that it has an absorption emission spectrum which show a couple of very important characteristics. There is a zero phonon line, which would be the energy required to transition from a ground state to an excited state with no phonon changes. Or rather, at the lowest zero phonon content entirely. And the spectra are symmetric around that. So the absorption spectrum and the emission spectra are effectively mirror images around that zero phonon line. And furthermore, the tail on one side is a Boltzmann factor relative to the tail on the other side. In other words, there's a Boltzmann factor between the absorption and emission spectra of this system. You'll notice that the spectra are something like 50 nanometers wide. And so what we're going to do is we're going to put the light inside a microcavity. A microcavity is very simply two mirrors of order of a few wavelengths or a few half wavelengths of light long. The free spectral range of this cavity for longitudinal modes is of order 100 nanometers, maybe 50 nanometers. So it's as large, if not larger, than the width of the absorption and emission spectra. In other words, there is only one longitudinal mode of any interest. But we can make any old shape we like of cavity. We can make contoured mirrors, we can have flat mirrors, but they all have many transverse possible modes, but only one longitudinal mode. This will be a 2D system. Importantly, of those transverse modes, there will be one transverse mode, which is the lowest energy mode. This sets a ground state for the system. So if you think of Bose-Einstein condensation as being macroscopic occupation of a ground state, now we at least have defined a proper ground state. We have a gap and a very well-defined ground state. The effect is that photons in these microcavities act very much like a massive particle. They have a dispersion relation which is quadratic for all the same reasons that have been discussed before, I guess, and especially if you were here way back at, I guess, someone like, I don't know if David Snook gave a talk or Marcin Szymanska will have described microcavity photons and how they have quadratic dispersion relations. The curvature of a mirror, if we choose to use a spherical mirror, which is approximately parabolic, then it looks like a harmonic oscillator. So we get the states of a harmonic oscillator, the appropriate energy spacings and degeneracies. So we now start to have something which looks like massive particles in a harmonic trap at thermal equilibrium, which looks remarkably like the kind of atomic BCs that people use as canonical, except if this is actually coupled to a bath, which is the dye and the thermal vibrations around.
So longitudinally, you mean this direction?
Yes. Longitudinal will be from one mirror to the other, the optic axis, and the transverse will be in the plane of the
picture. Parallel with the mirror.
Yep.
So why would the mirror would give you, I mean, maybe not to everybody else except myself, to give a harmonic trap in the, suppose that's the insane direction, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
It's open end?
Yes, but it's sufficiently deep that it's irrelevant how it's open.
So there's nothing on the ends, right?
The way to think about this is that at the edges, the cavity is short, so the minimum energy required to match the boundary condition of resonance is high compared to the middle of the cavity where the cavity is long. So you get a potential energy landscape which is simply dictated by the topography of the mirror. You simply need to shape the mirror and you get a potential energy trap.
So effectively the trapping in this direction.
The trap is within the plane. So yeah, the other way of thinking about it is if you put some light in, it's refocused by one of the mirrors.
So I can see the light is trapped in this direction.
Yep.
I was thinking they can escape in that.
It can escape longitudinally through the mirrors because there is a small.
Also, escape in this direction.
These are spherically symmetric mirrors.
They can escape from the edge, right?
They can do, but the you will find that it's not thermally accessible to reach the edge of these mirrors for most of our systems. There is one subsystem I can show you where it is.
The population on the edge is very low.
The population at the edge will be very low, yes. We can pretend that the system is effectively infinite or that the edge is just a loss mechanism.
So which way is the severe loss mechanism? Is through the middle?
I will come to that in a moment.
Okay.
So the basic idea is we now have a pair of mirrors, a die, a pump. This is one of the mirrors. It's a millimeter across, planar mirror, with a little bit of optics, but nothing particularly fancy. The other mirror is a standard half-inch diameter, 500 millimeter radius of curvature mirror. For these experiments, we have done some fabrication mirrors, but it's just to say that the apparatus is really incredibly simple. And you can basically just buy most of it off the shelf. They are very good quality mirrors because we want to have the photons trapped inside this cavity for perhaps as much as a nanosecond, and given how short the cavity is, you need to have many, many bounces, so we have finesse of something like 50,000, 60,000. And then some of the light leaks out, and we image that onto any old detector we like, spectrometers, cameras, single photon detectors, whatever. So here's what the result looks like. This is the spectrum as a function of the varying the pump power. Now, varying the pump power effectively varies the chemical potential. It varies the number of particles or excitations in the system. And below threshold, you see, at long wavelengths, you see a cutoff. At short wavelengths of high energy, you have something here which is compatible with room temperature. So this should be an exponential 1 over kt. This looks like 1 over kt, basically. This is completely compatible with room temperature. And you see a sort of roll-off here, which is a density of states factor for the harmonic oscillator in two dimensions. Pretty straightforward. As you increase the total population, or the chemical potential, more and more particles pile in. The excited states saturate, and the ground state gets all the extra photons, and they all pile into the ground state, and that's the Bose-Einstein condensation, because that is macroscopic occupation of the lowest energy mode at thermoequilibrium.
Do you have any depletion of the ground state? Is this the lowest harmonic oscillator state, or do you have some kind of chemical potential there which would lead to a Thomas Fermi distribution?
I'm not going to talk any more about interactions in here, but the way of characterizing interactions for a 2D atomic Bose gas, there's a dimensionless two-dimensional dimensionless two-dimensional interaction parameter, typically written as G tilde in sort of papers by people like Dalibar and Hazy-Ravitch, where in coal atoms in a typical sort of rubidium-87 experiment, you get 0.1, which suggests that interactions in coal atoms are perturbative but significant. Okay? Here we have something like 10 to the minus 5. The interactions are really small, and the efforts that have been done by other groups to try to detect them have suggested the interactions are just very small, and probably they are not contact interactions. They are probably retarded interactions, which makes it a whole mess to try to work out what's going on. I won't talk more about them in this talk. We can discuss it later. The other bit of data I want to show you is an image, a real space image, of this is the gas below threshold. So remember, it's an atomic equivalent, effectively an atomic gas in a harmonic potential, which should be a Gaussian, whose size is dictated by the temperature and the confinement, in other words, the radius of curvature of the mirrors. And so here we see something that looks like a Gaussian, but it's yellow in the middle and green at the edge, not because I've chosen some strange color scheme, because this is a real color image. We have the low energy states in the middle and the high energy states at the edge. When you increase the population to overpopulate the ground state is in the middle, and so you get a bright spot in the middle. Great. My team was not the first to do this. We were the second to do this. I want to give lots of credit to Martin Weitz in Bonn, who did this first in 2010. I think there's a few other groups who've managed it. There's Dries van Oosten in Utrecht. There's Jan Klaers in Twente, who's an escapee of Martin Weitz's group. There's a couple other groups who do similar things. Similar physics can also be done in plasmonic lattice arrays by Ivi Tornamo in Finland, and possibly also in erbium-doped fiber lasers by Baruch Fischer in Israel. So there's a few other experiments which use very, very similar concepts to do things like Bose-Einstein condensation of light. I will spend a bit more time talking about not the equilibrium behavior, which is what quite a lot of the other people in the field seem to focus on, but I want to talk about the non-equilibrium behavior, where we deviate from the Bose-Einstein distribution, and the approximation that thermal equilibrium is really not valid. So, for that, we will need a model. The model we use is principally due to Peter Curtin and Jonathan Keeling in St Andrews in Scotland. And this is a very, very brief summary of it. If you want more details, I can give them at the end, but I think maybe in the interest of time, I'll just give you the idea that it starts with a Hamiltonian, where you have a fairly standard James Cummings Hamiltonian with some extra boltons. You have the photon energy for given modes, labeled M here. You have the energy associated with the molecules being excited or ground state, so molecule I being in its excited or ground state. And you have the coherent coupling between a photon in a cavity mode, M, and a molecule I. Okay, this is your James Cummings Hamiltonian. All of this is multimode, multimolecule, so it's summed over everything. And there is an extra term in here, which is the vibrational degree of freedom of the molecule, the phonons, where you have some energy of the phonons plus some coupling between the phonon and the electronic degree of freedom of the molecule, which essentially is because when you excite a molecule, it distorts. It mechanically distorts. So there is some interaction between them. One then goes through a procedure of a polaron transform, and then you effectively eliminate the phononic degree of freedom, making a Markov approximation. So you turn this into a kind of Lindbladian master equation, where we have the Hamiltonian dynamics, which frankly are not the interesting thing in this particular system. It's all the dissipative dynamics that we're interested in. And there are approximately five terms in this version of it. There is cavity loss of photons. Not surprising. There is a dissipative term associated with exciting the molecules, the pumping. There is an equivalent term of loss from the molecules through all degrees of freedom which do not involve the cavity. So this could be non-radiative loss, or it could be spontaneous emission into free space. We don't really care. Those photons are lost to silence. And there are two terms which involve exchange of particle of excitation between cavity mode and molecule. There is absorption from the cavity to excite a molecule, and there is emission from the molecule into the cavity. And they are dissipative terms because the vibrational relaxation is so fast that there is no coherence left between the exchange of excitation between molecule and cavity.
So if I understand correctly, this is not a Hamiltonian term, but it's an incoherent exchange of...
Yes.
And you destroy the phase because of this...
Because the phononic relaxation, the dipole of the molecule is completely randomized very quickly. We are going to place ourselves in a circumstance where the reabsorption is strong. This is part of the thermalization. Right? If we want to have thermalization, we need reabsorption so that the photons can scatter off the molecules. So we need to have many absorption events. So the light and the matter do interact strongly in our system, but they don't do so in a coherent way. We end up with what you might want to think of as something like an incoherent version of strong coupling cavity QED. So some of the interesting effects like vacuum Rabi splitting drop away, but some of the other effects of number correlations will remain eventually. So one can, if you want, for certain circumstances, make further approximations. There's basically no particular interesting off-diagonal terms in this in terms of the phase, because phase is really lost, at least for a lot of the population problems we want. And you can even approximate this to pretending there's a single mode or pretending that the molecules are all in one space. Or there are all sorts of approximations you can make, and you'll derive simple rate equations for populations of photons in given modes, or you'll derive a rate equation or coupled equations for populations of molecules in different positions, and we can do other things. This is just examples, and actually this particular version of it is the simplest version, which makes all sorts of approximations, and in the right limit with very low cavity loss and things, you actually recover the Bose-Einstein distribution. Because, of course, you have both stimulated emission, which plays the role of stimulated scattering that would happen in something like an atomic BC, and the population far below threshold, for example, of something like this, which is an active medium inside a cavity, which often is thought of as a laser, that the population of a given mode depends on the gain at that for that mode, which is dependent on the emission spectrum, divided by the absorption spectrum. And in this case, it's because the absorption is a loss mechanism. So the net gain for a given mode is the ratio of absorption to emission, which is our Boltzmann factor. So we find out that the populations of different modes are a Boltzmann factor. That's the reason. So one can extend this model to include the effects of inhomogeneous excitations and things like this, which we do need to do, and we have done. I won't go into the details here. But the behavior you get out from this model, as you, for example, vary the pump rate, you can track the populations of different modes, the ground state and some several excited modes, and as you increase the pump rate, you get the population of a mode suddenly jumps up. That's a threshold, that's a phase transition, that's the BEC, that's lasing, depending on how you want to call it, and then carries on increasing linearly. So these are on a log-log scale, so that this characteristic S-shaped curve is the characteristic of a threshold. You also note that the excited state population of molecules in overlapping with that mode starts to get clamped. That gain clamping is what causes the other modes to start to saturate in their population. But later on, if you pump harder, if you increase the pumping further, you get other modes go above threshold. The clamping is not perfect. There are the interplay of excitations of molecules in different spaces in the cavity relative to the spatial overlap with different modes is what causes this. You get multiple modes going above threshold, and even more strangely, sometimes you get modes going below threshold. You can call it evaporation, anti-condensation. We call it decondensation. It's a very strange phenomenon of when you increase the pump rate, actually sometimes the population goes down in some modes. it's effectively competition for gain that's causing this. And we can generalize this whole point to not just looking at the populations, but actually assigning a phase transition to each of these sort of jumps, and deciding in a larger parameter space what is the phase the system is in. What is the if we think of this as a system which is the steady state solution of some rate equations, we're only doing the steady state things here, that would be one of the definitions of a dynamical phase transition, where you get a different steady state as a function of the control parameters. So here is that sort of non-equilibrium phase diagram, or dynamic phase diagram, if you like, as a function of the pump rate and the probability a photon will be reabsorbed before it leaves the cavity. We can control that by tuning the length of the cavity, by tuning where the cutoff of the lowest energy mode sits in the absorption spectrum, how strong the absorption is. And we see on the left where we have very, very little reabsorption. There's like 10% chance a photon will be reabsorbed. You go from something which doesn't have any condensate to something's gone above threshold, but we don't know what. On the far right, where we have about 10 reabsorption cycles before cavity loss kicks in, you get something below threshold, which actually will match the Boltzmann distribution, and then you get a BEC. You get a macroscopic population of the ground state, and no other mode will go above threshold. On the left, this laser in the middle we have a variety of what we call multimode condensates, where multiple modes can be above threshold, including the ground state. And this, what we've called a laser here, is where at least one mode goes above threshold, but not the ground state. That's an artificial distinction between a laser and a BEC, but we had to call it something. And so this really tells us something about how thermal equilibrium breaks down in the system. On the right, we have really good thermal equilibrium, and the system just matches the Bose-Einstein distribution. As you keep the pumping fixed, you can go from BEC to multimode to even a system where not even the ground state is going below threshold. That's an interesting phase diagram because if you compare it to a thermodynamic phase diagram, a thermodynamic phase diagram pretty much never has things like quadruple points. It only has triple points. You can show this as a simple geometric argument for this, actually, which goes back to Gibbs from like 1870. But here we can actually have multi-points, which are beyond 4 points. Probably beyond 3 points, I don't know about beyond 4 points. So we see it's not the same as a thermal equilibrium phase diagram, but it's nonetheless an interesting setup that we can explore. And that's what comes out of the model. That's not an experimental phase diagram, that's a theoretical phase diagram. So let's have a play with some experiments where we can try to access some of these things. And what we're going to do is we're going to go to a limit where there are very few particles. So I said yesterday in my sort of introduction to myself, one of the questions I'm interested in is what happens when you take phase transitions away from their thermodynamic limit? What can we still justify the term phase transition? And when should we stop using it? And here we're going to take it. So previously I've just shown you out of the thermodynamic limit in the sense that these are not thermal equilibrium systems, but they do have many, many particles in them. If you look, there are as many as 10 to the 12 particles in the system. That's a big enough number. Here we're going to try to work with very few particles. To do that, it turns out we need to reduce the radius of curvature of our mirrors. That will increase the transverse mode spacing, and that reduces the number of thermally accessible modes, which reduces the number of particles you require to reach thermal equilibrium. Without going through the calculation, it turns out that our previous experiments with about half a meter radius of curvature required tens of thousands of photons of thermal equilibrium, which is just about enough to call it thermodynamic. We're going to aim for a few hundred microns, which gives us a few tens of particles, and then we're going to start to leave the thermodynamic limit. To do that, we needed a collaborator, a guy called Jason Smith in Oxford, and his team, who have fabricated some mirrors using focused ion beam milling, which reach the quality we need. And otherwise, the approach is the same. So let's just have a quick think about what happens to the phase transition as we make the system smaller in the sense of having fewer thermally accessible modes. We can do really basic undergraduate physics. We just take the Bose-Einstein distribution, which is exactly what I showed you before. We add it up over all of the different modes. So we just sum the Bose-Einstein distribution over discrete modes. We don't do any continuum thing here. We just take the discrete modes. And we know that it's a 2D harmonic oscillator for what we're doing, so we have a density of states becomes a straightforward degeneracy, which is just proportional to the the energy of the mode, and the energy of the mode is proportional to the quantum number of it, basically. And when you have a small mode spacing compared to temperature, you have many thermally accessible modes. This is the red line. You show that below threshold, there's a small fraction of the photons or the particles are in the ground state. And above the threshold for condensation, pretty much all the particles are in the ground state. That's pretty much what Bose-Einstein condensation really means. And there's a rather sharp jump, which is very reminiscent of the discontinuities you get in a phase transition. So the number of particles in the ground state will be our order parameter for this phase transition. And we're controlling here the total population, but we could equally be controlling the chemical potential. As we decrease the number of thermally accessible modes, either we decrease the temperature or we increase the mode spacing, we find that this transition becomes broader and shallower. The jump is not as big a jump, and the width of this transition, there's a bigger region which is neither clearly above threshold nor clearly below threshold. And in the limit where there is really only one mode which is thermally accessible, you really only have one particle goes into one state. And so there is no transition, right? There is no such thing as a Bose-Einstein condensation in one state. You either have all your particles in the state, or you have all your particles in the state, there's no threshold. So at some point, this concept of phase transition has disappeared. The other point is that we can see, did I not play that? Okay, fine. This, as an aside, a very similar thing is seen in lasers when you go to the microlaser limit, and the parameter which controls big or small is the ratio of spontaneous emission which goes into the cavity mode versus everywhere else. This is known as the beta factor, usually. And if the beta factor is close to 1, then your laser is very small, and all your population goes into that state. If your factor is very big, sorry, if beta is very, very small, then you find that you have a very sharp and large jump in the population in that mode as a function of your pump rate, because the system is effectively a big system. So here is an experimental equivalent. So what we do is we take the output of our cavity, we put it on a spectrometer, we can discriminate the individual populations of individual modes, we can calibrate and say how many photons were in a given energy level at a function of time. Not mode, we don't have a spatial degree of freedom, we can just discriminate by energy. And here is those populations as a function of modes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, energy levels rather, sorry. And you see that there is a kind of a broad threshold here. We have some saturation of the excited state populations. It's not perfect. The system is not perfectly at thermal equilibrium. We find a temperature of around about 150 Kelvin. It's not perfectly at thermal equilibrium. That's just the consequence of having not very many absorption events before each cavity loss event. And then we can use our non-equilibrium model. If we put the details in right, we can actually match slightly better than the thermal equilibrium values. We can match what the imperfect saturation of the excited states. And from the shape of this threshold kind of like curve, this like in, like out kind of curve, or the total number versus photon number, we can determine what is the approximate number of photons required to reach the threshold. We find 7 photons in the total system, which implies that the number in the ground state at threshold was about 2.5. So we have a very, very small condensate, which is very similar to a Bose-Einstein condensate. Not perfect, but very nearly a Bose-Einstein condensate. The other phenomenon that comes with this is if we measure the coherence of the ground state, we see that at about 1 photon, so not very dissimilar numbers to the number we see for the threshold for BEC, we see the coherence time goes up. And for large numbers, it follows a photons. It follows a sort of shallow Townes-like limit until we reach a multimode condensate, where, for some reason which we don't understand, the coherence time plummets even below the limit when there were very few particles. The coherence time at the low particle number end is dominated by loss, be it cavity loss or be it reabsorption rate. We can show that the coherence time is distinctly determined by the sum of those two loss mechanisms. Absorption is a thermalization mechanism, but it's also a decoherence mechanism. So this comes from an extension to the model where we do take into account phase coherence to a lowest order approximation. So we also see multimode condensation. I won't spend very long doing it, but you have experiments, you have theory. This little inset tells you the fraction of particles in the condensate, so the lowest energy mode, as a function of the pump power rather than the total number of particles, but it's equivalent. For Wavelengths where the cavity is very deep into the absorption spectrum of the dye, we get lots of reabsorption, lots of thermalization. We get a very large fraction of the particles go into the BEC because it's well thermalized. We get something like 95%. For a parameter where we get perhaps 0.1 or 0.2 absorption events per loss rate, so we have very little reabsorption, some modes which are not the ground state go above threshold, and the proportion in the ground state actually drops as you go into high powers. And in an intermediate regime, we get first Bose-Einstein condensation and then multimode condensation. And so we get we terminate at a finite fraction of the particles go into the ground state. And all this matches pretty well with the model. It turns out the cavities weren't particularly brilliant. We only got 5 picoseconds instead of the 500 picoseconds lifetime we wanted, but that's okay. The physics still came out as being interesting. I want to digress on how one determines or determines where is the phase transition in the system, because it's really very arbitrary where I place the phase transition here. And I've chosen a line here where when the number in a particular state goes above that line, I'm going to say that's above threshold. That line is where the number in a given state is equal to the square root of the total number. There are several reasons why one would argue that, but the main line I would like to think about is this. Condensation is a phenomenon which doesn't just require Bose-Einstein stimulation. You can have any other kind of stimulation. It could be more classical. It could be there are systems which involve evolutionary games they're called rock, paper, scissors games between different animals. There are models of traffic flow which actually show very, very similar behavior. You set up a bunch of rate equations and there is some stimulation of transitions of populations from one species to another. And these things show at some low population, total population system, the populations of individual modes all scale linearly with a constant fraction of the total population. Then some threshold region is reached where some modes condense and some modes are depleted. The depleted modes, their population stays basically constant. Their fraction drops towards zero. The fraction of the total drops towards zero at large numbers of total. Whereas other modes remain condensed. They go to a constant fraction of the total population. This is a paper from André Eckhart's group on driven Bose gases. So they have some shaking lattice kind of dynamics. But there are also things in other systems, from particularly Owen Fry's group have a really good paper here. They show this kind of phase transition. So this is lasers, BECs, all sorts of systems show this phase transition. But the theoretical definition here that's used, which says that the fraction of a given mode, if it stays finite as the total population goes to infinity, the fraction stays finite. That definition cannot be accessed experimentally. I cannot access infinity particles in my system. At some point, it blows up, literally. So I have to find some experimental definition, which is accessible at finite particle numbers. There are several different criteria you can use at equilibrium or non-equilibrium for the Bose gases. You usually have a reasonably well-defined criterion. They're outlined here. Perhaps I don't have time to go through this. There is a paper I have these in the supplementary materials, all detailed. But the point is that the simplest way to discriminate between a depleted state whose population goes saturates and a condensed population whose population goes linearly with the total population is to simply discriminate with the power law, which is halfway between 0 and 1. So the square root law works pretty well experimentally. You also might think it relates to fluctuations in a Poissonian system where you get a square root law. And in two dimensions, it relates very well to the Bose-Einstein distribution. There are fairly canonical definitions for that. So the square root law works pretty well for us. You might find a different number works. And in one dimension, you would find probably this doesn't work. I haven't tried it in one dimension, but it would be interesting to try it. So that is why I used this threshold criterion. And for that threshold criterion, we find 7 particles in total, and square root of 7 particles in the ground state at BEC. And so we have a very, very small system at phase transition. At that point, I'm going to leave behind the steady state behavior and move on to the dynamics, which is very recent stuff coming out of my lab. So we have some theory work where we take the same model, and instead of solving the steady state behavior, we solve the dynamics. It required a few little bits of numerical techniques, which you can read about in these papers. Don't ask me too many details of it. I feel like I'm an experimentalist, not a theorist. I'm working with Florian Mintup, who's the theorist in charge, and Henry Yu is the PhD student who did most of these calculations. That's why I wrote these papers, principally. And what we can show is that when you... This is the same graph I showed you before as the populations as a function of pump rate.
Give a pair in number two.
Sorry?
Two papers posted almost at the same time.
They were, yes. They are companion papers. We submitted them as a pair of papers. We are still under peer review. But they are, at the moment, a pair of papers. Maybe they get merged after peer review. Who knows? So the point is that when you reach the threshold for condensation, the typical time it takes to reach equilibrium after a small quench in the parameter, so you just step from one parameter to another, diverges. This is critical slowing down. And you can straightforwardly show this is an inverse one power law, that the time it takes is one over the distance in parameter space between your current parameter and the threshold parameter. This is not entirely unsurprising, and in principle would tell us something about the universality class of this phase transition, if only I knew anything about universality classes. So we see this for the condensation threshold, we see this for the multimode condensation threshold, we see it for other thresholds, but then something strange happens at very high pump powers. At higher pump powers than the decondensation threshold, we see a non-critical slowing down by at least two orders of magnitude. And you can look at the structure of the equations of motions and extract that timescale, but it's very long, and it's not very obvious. And so we call this a non-critical slowing down phenomenon, which is different from the usual, and perhaps is related to the fact that an important susceptibility of the system, the number of particles as a function of the derivative of the number of particles as a function of pump power, so that susceptibility has an inversion, it's negative. So normally, you would think that close to a threshold, fluctuations are increased, and the timescale is slow, and those are linked, but the same phenomenon in some sense. And those would be linked, if you're close to equilibrium, you would think of those as being a fluctuation dissipation relation, where the amplitude of the fluctuations depends on how close you are to the threshold, because the susceptibilities depend on how close you are to the threshold. And likewise, the timescales depend on how close you are to the threshold. In this case, because the susceptibility has an inversion of sign, perhaps there is some reason why it slows down. I don't know. That's only a guess, really. Anyway, so what we can do is now we can look at these dynamics experimentally. So what we have is a
5 minutes.
I think I might be able to get there. So we have a pulsed laser, which is faster than the dynamics. We have different mirrors, which are the large radius of curvature mirrors, which have a few hundred picoseconds of time scale. And the absorption time scale can be a few hundred picoseconds in this as well. So we can show, this is a map of, you change the pump energy, you measure the time, and you see what is the intensity of light that's emitted. And so if you're far below threshold, you get a prompt rise in the emitted light, and then an exponential decay with a spontaneous emission lifetime. Nothing particularly exciting. For very high pulse energies, you get a stimulated pulse of light out, which is pretty much as fast as... It's not quite as fast as our detectors go, but pretty much. It's very fast. So we get a very prompt emission of light. But in between, when you are close to the threshold, the dynamics is much, much slower. So slow that if you were to fix a particular time, you would have a non-monotonic behavior of output light as a function of pump intensity. You have some very, very slow dynamics, and so you get light emitted very slowly. And why is that? The way we think about it is we think about the Bose-Einstein condensation, or laser condensation, whichever you want to call it, is a stimulated emission event, but it must be seeded with a spontaneous event. Or several spontaneous events, actually. And so here's a simple Monte Carlo simulation of one mode and the light coming out, and you pump some excitations in with the laser, and you see that sometimes you get very few excitations come out, and it takes a very long time before the process can run away. Other times you get a very prompt emission. And so you find that the time at which the pulse comes out is fluctuating. And the closer you are to threshold, the more times you can go up and down and up and down, the more spontaneous events, more stochastic events you can have before deciding yes or no, I've gone above threshold or not. And so you find that the average dynamics is slow, but it's not clear whether it's most of the dynamics is slow or sometimes you get a prompt response and sometimes you get very, very slow responses. So we'd like to look at the statistics of the phase transition to understand the two roles of average dynamics and fluctuations. So for this, we have a new tool, which is two-time correlations. So it's two times absolute timing. So not just a stationary statistics where you measure the correlation function as a function of delay, but you expect it to be the same at all times. Because we have an absolute reference of time, which is the pump pulse, we now measure the correlation function as a function of two times. So we just take the light, split it, look at two detectors. We attenuate it so hard that we have very few counts per event. So we know that these are the correlation statistics. This is a normalized G2 with a color map which diverges at 1. So on the diagonal, you find basically you just get the noise on the intensity. And you get something which is above 1, naturally, because these are bosons, basically. And that's what's shown here at the bottom, is you get some noisy thing. I don't actually know quite why did I put this graph. It's a terrible graph. I haven't really remembered what it explains. The pulse starts late. Basically, it starts at around about 1,000 picoseconds. It's very close to threshold. And G2 is always at least 1, and it goes through some phases where it's a bit bigger than 1, because we have some noise. But interestingly, on the off diagonal, we have some quite strong anti-correlations. And the explanation for that is this timing jitter in the pulse. If you had a pulse early, you have a large probability of detecting a photon early and a low probability of detecting a photon late. So that is early detected late, and this would be late but detecting early. So we have this anti-correlation due to timing jitter. We have both amplitude fluctuations and timing jitter, and we can see those by looking at the diagonal and the off diagonal of this map. So that's a really useful tool for helping us understand this phase transition, which is far from equilibrium. We also are looking at trying to extend the theory. This is with a postdoc called Himadri who's doing this. And we return to the rate equations we had before, but we now extend them to include the correlations between certain parameters to the lowest possible order. So this is the average populations, the average of photons, the average populations of molecules, the fluctuations of the photon number, fluctuations of the molecule number, and the cross-correlation between molecule and photon number. And they change the equations of motions. I do apologize for the change of notation, but that's what happens over a few years, with some extra terms come into. This is just one of the 5 coupled equations. And you can extract from that fairly straightforwardly the zero time delay correlations, and we are trying to use a quantum regression relation to extract the two-time correlations. That point, I should conclude that we have this really interesting phase diagram of a very, very simple physical system. We have a very interesting phase diagram. We can poke and probe at what the meaning of phase transitions actually are, and we can push down to the smallest BECs to do that. And we can now characterize some of the phase transition through these non-stationary statistics. And we have a bunch of other things we're going to do later with semiconductor materials and metamaterials instead of microcavities and all sorts of stuff. It remains for me to thank the many people who've done this: Ben, Henry, João, Himadri, the PhD students and postdocs, and Florian and Rupert, the academics who do this with me, and the funding bodies, lots of collaborators and the funding bodies, in particular the UK EPSRC and the European Union with the Quantum Tech Photons for Quantum Simulation Program. Thank you for your attention.
Very articulate everything nobody.
Yes.
Is there a system where you could do this in 1D?
In 1D?
Yeah.
Yes.
Some wave guide.
Let's go through the bonus material to the unused slides. There we go. So we can microfabricate any shape we like of these mirrors, and that tells you the trapping potential. So these are a gallery of things that the student Ben has done with a collaborator in Oxford. And you can do flat bottom square potentials, you can do waveguide type potentials, Mexican hat potentials, all sorts of things with interesting topologies. But the one you're probably interested in is effectively the waveguide. So we could do this in 1D harmonic or 1D flat bottom. And your question is, what do you expect? So you expect that the density of first of all, the density of states is different. So you don't necessarily have one and only one ground state. In which case, I think you get an overpopulation, but you don't get long-range phase coherence. So you get something like quasi-condensate will be the first
two-step condensation, for example, if you have very unequal confinement.
Yeah, this is also possible. So we have some elliptical structures which you would possibly think of something like that. Yeah.
Can I ask you two questions?
Yeah, of course.
This question. First one, you already mentioned it. You make it like a retargeting interaction.
Yes.
For some problem. Can you elaborate a little more? So it's like, can you make that interaction very strong? And what is the timeline scale?
So there are two proposed mechanisms for interactions in photon condensates. One of them is a thermal interaction where the thermalization mechanism exchanges energy between a photon and a thermal bath of phonons. So the dye and the liquid around it is actually heating up. Okay. That changes the refractive index, which changes the effective length, which acts like a potential. So you now have an intensity-dependent potential, which is effectively an interaction. That's retarded by the diffusion of heat. So the argument is at zero time you have a contact interaction, but at long times you can have a diffusive kind of interaction. And furthermore, it's complicated because if you run many pulses of the experiment, if you run it many times, it depends on the history of the experiment because it can have memories of milliseconds or even seconds. That's the first and rather slow interaction. The other interaction mechanism is the Kerr effect mediated by saturating the excited state of the molecules. So there, the Kerr effect typically takes a time scale equivalent to the spontaneous emission lifetime to set up and reach something approximating steady state. That spontaneous emission lifetime is about 4 nanoseconds, which implies that in the few hundred picoseconds we have for our typical time scales on the experiment, the experiment is still in the apparatus is still in its transient phase.
It's a very long time.
It's a very long time, or it's a transient.
Long, yeah. Retarding.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the matter materials. I'm pretty sure your source might be something new. So what would it be different from the case you have done?
So what's fun with the metamaterials? You can think of a planar slab, a waveguide slab, and then you propagate your light through this. And then if you pattern the slab, you can create a band gap in the material. And then you can have your same distribution with a minimum energy and so on, but now in a material which is in a plane. And if you pump light in at one end, and you can cover it with dye to make sure the light as it propagates through the system would interact with dye, but if you pump at one end in a steady state, it takes time to propagate. And so now you have one transverse dimension of space and one dimension which is effectively time. And so then we can gain temporal control over the condensate. So we could, for example, do adiabatic compressions or something, or we could pattern a dye at one temperature in one place and another temperature in another place, and we could do a kind of like, you could imagine even going through like a Carnot cycle with light or something like this, which would be really fun. I can't, you know, it might not happen.
The speed is different in two directions, that's what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. The best reference for this one would be to look into the plasmonic lattice papers that people have done by Paivi Torma and also Jamie Rivas Gomez, I think, in possibly Delft. So they've done plasmonic lattices, and if you look through the calculation, you really do see this kind of dispersion relation, and they look at things propagating in time, quasi-time.
So we should thank the speaker, both speakers, right?